Cockle Croup B is one of the biggest killers of young children in this country.
The father of Chelsea footballer John Terry has been cleared of a racist attack. Ted Terry had been on trial after being accused of headbutting an Asian man outside a pub in London and calling him a racist name last March. President Putin has gone on Russian TV to declare that Crimea is now officially a part of Russia. It comes as the Europeans agreed a range of new measures in response to Moscow's annexation of the peninsula. The international operation to try to find the missing Malaysia Airlines plane hasn't discovered anything for a second day. The area being examined in the southern Indian Ocean has now been widened. Schools in England that are rated as good are to get shorter but more frequent checks from the school's watchdog, Ofsted. As part of an overhaul of inspections, failing schools will get longer, more in-depth visits. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2.
Yeah, tune in on Sundays at 7 p.m. right here on BCFM to hear this crazy alien bringing you the latest and greatest in contemporary Christian music. That's me, Danny Lopsch. Join me on Sunday. The mothership is calling,
but I'll be back on Sunday at 7 p.m. I'm Danny Lopsch.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock again, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping review this week's news is the PCS Union's National Vice President, John McAnally. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Russia is kicked out of the G8 and the EU imposes sanctions over Crimea and Russia. In Crimea, 92% vote to join Russia. The Ukraine TV boss is beaten up for allowing Putin's speech on Ukrainian television. What does Martin make of it all? And nothing to ease the housing crisis in Wednesday's budget speech. So as rents spiral ever upwards, despite no increases really in real wages, Bristol's 24/7 writer and blogger, former City Councillor Tessa Coombs, joins us to help pick apart why Britain's housing market is broken, why Osborne refuses to fix it, and what we should be doing to get Bristol's 15,000 registered homeless people properly housed. Also, a head teacher and other Maldives Islanders say they saw Malaysian Airlines MH370 flying low early that Sunday morning and heading south. How do all the people who stepped in instantly to deny their eyewitness story know that they didn't see anything? Is that one of the reasons why the families of the lost are getting so angry? Also, though the BBC aren't reporting it, Occupy London is still going strong as a think tank and with discussion groups. So we hear from Clive Menzies, Occupy's analysis of the European Union. Also, part three of Paul Mason's series that he thinks could not be made in Britain today. He's the former BBC Newsnight economics correspondent, now on Channel 4 News. Tonight, the First World War, part three, The Revolutions. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 2 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs up at 10, sunny spells and a few light showers. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, sunnier at the beginning of the week with some showers towards the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 25th and the 30th of March, highs of 10 degrees Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is PCS Union's National Vice President, John McAnally. Hi, John, and welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, by way of explaining what the PCS Union is, one of the reasons I like getting the trade unions on here is because I sat down and did some calculations last year. The trade unions actually have got 15 times more members in this country than the political parties, and also they're far more democratic. Now, I know you're not going to disagree with that, but tell us, how does the PCS actually form policy? policy makes decisions in your trade union, and how many people are members of it?
Well, first of all, it's a civil service trade union. It's got over 250,000 members. It represents people in the various government departments, DWP, HMRC, Ministry of Justice. We form policy through the democratic processes of the union itself, where we have conferences in the various departmental groups. We have a national conference. Members discuss in their branches. They talk about the things that affect them and their workplaces. They talk about wider issues, and the union forms policy on that basis.
Now, do you take views on right across the spectrum? Say, for example, there's been a lot of controversy about some trade unions voting to boycott Israel. These sorts of issues, some would argue, they've really got nothing to do with people's jobs as civil servants in this country.
It's an old argument, but the fact of the matter is, you can't build a wall around yourself, whether it be in a trade union or anything else, and pretend the rest of the world doesn't exist. We believe in equality, we believe in fairness, we're opposed to war, and I think that's true of most working class people. So it's not unnatural that the union would have a view. But it's also about international solidarity as well, on the example that you used. If people have been treated badly in one country, it does always have an impact at some point on people here. So yes, our main job is to protect our members' interests, our terms and conditions, our wages, but it would be very odd if we didn't look beyond that as well.
John, well, one of the reasons that it's so good to have you here is because I actually looked around on the internet to find a good analysis of this week's budget, and the PCS, I think quite a lot of this is borrowed from the TUC announcement, partly, but on the PCS website there's a very good analysis saying Britain needs a pay rise. Well, I think this is the one thing that wasn't really addressed by George Osborne on Wednesday in the budget, is the really difficult squeeze that people are having with the cost of living. It's called by the Labour Party the cost of living crisis. Yeah. I suppose, you know, in past times it was probably called other things, like, you know, how much money, the pound in your pocket, this kind of thing. Our money just simply isn't going as far as it was and as far as it needs to. For many people, they're working part-time, several jobs, some of them very unreliable, on 0 hours contracts, this kind of thing. And they're finding it very difficult to pay basic things. We're going to be talking about housing in part two, about rent, but also simple things like electricity bills, sometimes childcare bills as well, and there's a general squeeze going on, it seems, in the sort of bottom half of society. So anyway, what are your thoughts about what you heard on Wednesday and what the Tories are doing with our, after all it is our taxpayers' money?
Yeah, first of all, could I say probably the TUC borrowed it from us. It was we were the originators of the phrase Britain needs a pay rise. The point I'm making is our union's been right at the forefront of fighting against austerity, and we've done the research on it. We produced our alternative very, very early. But in terms of the budget, I mean, I think the key message from George Osborne was no end to austerity, a continuation of an unremitting class war against the vast majority of people in the country.
Well, I didn't hear the class war bit in his speech.
Well, I was just going to go on to that. I'll tell you why. It is because he's turned a blind eye in the budget to the poverty. Let me give you some of the statistics. And this is the government statistics, not ours. There are 13 million people in this country living in poverty. There's 1.8 million families looking for homes. Youth unemployment is at sky high levels. You've already mentioned the cutting of rights and 0 hours contracts. When universal credit does come in, if it ever does come in, that's a story in itself. There'll be between 5 and 6 million people in work, not unemployed, not disabled, in work, claiming universal credit, which tells us about the low wage economy that's been created in this country over the course of the past period.
But that's around about 10% of the population, isn't it?
It's a large percent of the population. As far as we, as you excuse the phrase, as taxpayers are concerned, you know, we are subsidising low-paying employers now, including the government and the councils, to the tune of billions a year. We've also got as well the pushing ahead with welfare reform. The latest attack, and this is where the class war stuff comes in, is an arbitrary cap on social security spending. We're now in the seventh richest country in the world. We've food banks. We see poverty on a third world level, and surely any politician would be hang their head in shame that we have that situation. But it's not bad for everybody. The energy companies, E.ON for example, has seen a 26% rise in its profits on the back, incidentally, of a 9% price rise, which is leaving us with a situation where some people in this country now can't afford to eat, can't afford to eat properly, can't afford to heat their homes. But let me tell you this story. When I go around and speak to our members, let's just remember, these are civil servants, servants of the Crown. I'm told that many people, they tell me directly in themselves, they have to go to pay loan companies before the month is out in order to pay the bills. But as I say, it's okay for some. In terms of the elite, they have got an extra, on average, £24,000 in their pockets each year. And we had that statistic came out from Oxfam that in Britain, five of the richest people own more than the bottom 20%. And of course, there's an even more shocking statistic, if you like, in an international level, because austerity is international. 85 people, that's 85 human beings, have got more personal wealth than the bottom the poorest 3.5 billion of humanity. So that's not class war. I don't know what else you would call it.
John, you mentioned the universal credit there, and maybe you could just tell us what's happening with that. It is a story in itself. It was supposed to be implemented by now. I believe that Ian Duncan-Smith, the Work and Pension Secretary, was in Bath weekend before last, I think it was, to have a look at how these pilot schemes are going. Apparently they're not going too well. And ultimately, there's another problem with universal credit. If and when people get sanctioned with that, that doesn't just mean they can't eat. That also means they may get evicted from their homes. So what's happening with universal credit?
Oh, Tony, I could be here to 12 o'clock tonight talking about universal credit, but the simple message is it is an unmitigated shambles. It's not just a case that it is not working and there's been a few problems. It is in complete chaos. The private sector has just walked away with over £100 million for work that they don't need to do because the whole system was wrong in terms of IT. They're now looking at the whole thing again. There's no guarantee that they're going to get it right this time. And of course, if public servants were responsible for this rather than Tory ministers and the private companies, then you know we would be castigated. But the fact of the matter is, in fact, as far as Duncan Smith is concerned, really it is such a shambles. He really should be looking at his own position, as far as I can see. Universal credit in itself is not necessarily a bad way to go. A universal benefit is not necessarily a bad idea, but they've brought it in on the basis of a whole load of other, or they're trying to bring it in on the basis of a whole load of other conditions, including, in fact, conditionality itself, which they want to extend to people in work, let alone people who are not in work. And
what do you mean by this conditionality?
Well, for example, you could have the absurd situation that somebody working in a job centre on less than full hours a week is called in for an interview and they urged, if you like, if that's the right expression, to increase their hours. And as it stands at the moment, we could end up with a situation where people in work could be facing the same sanctions as the unemployed. And I want to just make the point, incidentally, that my union is absolutely opposed to sanctions, because you don't get people back to work by hitting them over the head. You get them back to work by helping them, by giving them encouragement. And of course, there's always a little matter of actually creating jobs. And going back to the budget, it's not a budget for creating jobs. They are bashing people who can't find work, but they will not invest in creating jobs in the economy. So I mean, the whole thing's a mess from start to finish.
Right, before we hear from Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's hear from George Osborne. And here's a little condensed into about a minute or so, some of the major announcements George Osborne made in the budget at Westminster on Wednesday. And I started with the rather, well, I found a quite comical introduction by the Deputy Speaker, which sounded almost like he was introducing someone onto the stage at a theatre or something. But anyway, we'll start with that. And here now is some of the major announcements in George Osborne's budget this week.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Right Honourable George Osborne.
We set out our plan, and together with the British people, we held our nerve. Yeah. We are now growing faster than Germany, faster than Japan, faster than the United States. We will fix the roof when the sun is shining to protect Britain from future storms, because we are all in this together. A weak leader who had risen to the top after betraying his brother. compelled by a gang of unruly barons to sign on the dotted line. Britain is better together. We're getting Britain building. You have earned it, you have saved it, and this government is on your side. This is a budget for the makers, the doers and the savers, and I commend it to the House.
Well, so just a few clips of George Osborne's budget speech there. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. He says we're all in it together, but we just heard from John there that actually what's happening is there's an increasing divide in wealth in this country. Oxfam and others pointing this out. This isn't just happening on an international scale. It's happening writ large here in Britain.
Well, it is. Of course it is. And, of course, it's very political, this budget, that the pensions changes mean that those who've saved, they get tax relief on saving for their pensions. Of course, many people haven't got any pensions in this country, which many people forget. And now, of course, they've got tax relief on the understanding that they wouldn't raid their pension pots until they got to the age where they were allowed to. And now, in order to try and get re-elected, he said you can raid these pension pots. Now, what that means, effectively, is he's encouraging the wealthy to go out and spend, and he's going to give them a ticket to do so in order to get re-elected. And damn the consequences, basically. The long term.
Well, surely spending is perfect. That's exactly what we need.
No. What we should be doing is spending poor. Spending should be targeted on poor people who are going to rebuild the economy from the bottom.
Well, this is the whole Martin, it doesn't matter who does the spending.
Oh, it does.
The spending must happen.
It does matter who does the spending. Because all the growth that we've got in the economy at the moment is based upon funny money and property prices. Mm. And in actual fact, you don't want the economy to grow on that basis. People would frankly be better off on the dole in the long term from the economic health of the country than doing stupid things in the short term. Because what happens when you specialise in low wage, low productivity activities, which is what Britain is doing, is you end up doing that forever. And in actual fact, in Finland, they would laugh at us, because the whole point is they would rather people sit on the dole, where they have generous dole in Scandinavia, rather than do stupid jobs which don't actually pay. And as has just been pointed out, many people are working, and if the employers had to pay them the full whack, they wouldn't be working. So in other words, it's subsidised work anyway. In other words, the economy is actually evolving in exactly the wrong direction. So when Osborne went there about the makers and the doers, they're exactly who aren't being helped by this budget. Investment in this country is at an all-time low. So in other words, companies are not investing in the future. And one of the reasons they're not investing in the future is because it's so much cheaper to get the government to subsidise people to do stuff.
Martin, you blithely use this term funny money. What on earth do you mean by that?
Quantitative easing, which is underpinning the whole thing. So we've had zero interest rates for 4 years, and we've been pumping money into the economy like it's going out of fashion. Certainly in the US, that's what they've been doing. And on the back of that, you get some kind of a recovery.
Just explain where that money comes from.
It's basically made up, and it's not. It's made up.
In the old days, they used to call it printing money, because it's like a kind of printing machine, just making money up.
The monetarists who dominated the economic policy in this country and the US in the 80s actually give up in the end, because they couldn't define what money was. They tried to control the money supply at the same time as deregulating the banks. So the question became: what is M1? What is M2? What is M3? M1 supposedly is just cash in circulation. And And Sir Alan Watts, I think it was, who is Thatcher's advisor, said, in the final analysis, the money supply is the cash in circulation, which is probably less than 1% of actual money. A derivatives contract can be passed from hand to hand like money. Money is just IOUs made up by the private sector, and the government doesn't control the money supply. Now, it should, but it doesn't.
Now, we heard some jokey stuff there about King John, some medieval crusade during the Crusades, and comparing him to Ed Miliband. But actually, more serious is the tax gap, John McAnally. You're the National Vice President of the PCS Civil Servants Union. In your union statement, it says, we believe the money lost to the economy through uncollected taxes and tax that is either avoided or evaded stands at well over the government's official estimate. Official figure is $35 billion, while we believe a more credible estimate would stand at over $100 billion. Now, tell us what's going on at HMRC, because these are the people who are supposed to collect this tax. The government are constantly saying we haven't got enough money for hospitals, schools, whatever. Surely, if the HMRC was a little bit beefed up, doing its job properly, we would have that money.
Well, it's not beefed up. As in every government department, jobs are being cut. There was a special unit in HMRC, a quite small skilled unit that was dealing with getting the tax back from the richest people in society. That unit was closed down. I think it was about 2 years ago. They're cutting staff, they're closing offices, they're going to close something like 160 odd inquiry offices, which will take access to for people generally to find out about tax out the equation. But the fact of the matter is there is no political will, and at the top of the HMRC there is far too cosy a relationship between them and the big companies. Now, it was my union, incidentally, who that worked very, very hard to expose what was going on in terms of taxation, because it's not long ago. It's only 5 or 6 years ago when somebody like John Redwood could go on TV and say it's okay to try and avoid taxes. That could not happen nowadays, and the reason it can't happen nowadays is because austerity has exposed the hypocrisy in the system itself. We've exposed it as a union, and we've also had UK Uncut and other organisations quite rightly bring that onto the streets.
But tax avoidance is perfectly legal. It's tax evasion, which is not.
Well, people can say it's I mean that definition is right, but they're both wrong. I mean, as far as tax is concerned, it's very, very simple. I pay my tax. I mean, you pay your tax. The rich should pay their taxes too. It really is. You know, it's a simple equation that everybody understands. The fact of the matter is, while they talk about welfare and so on, and the fact of the matter is that the big companies, the elite, are subsidised to the hilt, and on top of that, they get to evade and avoid their taxes as well. We need a rigorous tax system where people pay according to their means. If the tax was collected that's due, there'd be no need for cuts. If we had a transaction tax in the Europe, where there'd be no need for cuts. But it's not about that. It's about a transfer of wealth and power. It's about cutting the public sector, because the elite are ideologically opposed to the public sector. They believe that should be their money. In a sense, to put it in simple language, they don't just want a decent dinner, they want all the food on the table to the exclusion of everybody else. And you heard in the clip that you played there, those MPs' brain in the background. They really are. They wonder why they are treated with contempt. They bear no relationship to the broad mass of the people. There's now more millionaires in Parliament than ever. We've got a government composed almost entirely of millionaires. And it is corruption and graft from as far as these people are concerned. They want everything and they want to give nothing. And that is why there is real anger building up in this country.
I was getting a bit frustrated watching BBC's BBC One Question Time last night, looking at where we had a Conservative on the panel, and then we also had Danny Alexander, who's many people have said has got Stockholm Syndrome. He's trying to out conservative, the Conservatives. Then we had someone from the Centre for Policy Studies, which is a Conservative think tank. It was like, and also, of course, David Dimbleby. He's not really an honest broker, I don't think, in the middle there, because Boris Johnson pointed him out as a member of the Bullingdon Club when he was on Question Time. So, you know, the same club which George Osborne, Boris Johnson and David Cameron went to at Oxford. So, you know, it does seem that even when it comes to interpreting the budget, you know, the immediate Question Time BBC programme after that, you've got what are essentially four conservative-leaning people against, you know, maybe one Labour. But anyway, before you give your reply, John, let's hear from Ed Miliband, because he gave, actually, I think, a reasonably good performance. I was expecting to hear, Martin, maybe we can ask you this first, Ed Balls replying to George Osborne's speech, but actually it was Ed Miliband. Why is that?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know is a simple answer to that. It's probably, this is like criminology.
He was sat in the background. But no, anyway, it was Ed that, that replied to the budget speech. So let's have a listen to that now.
They don't want to talk about the low-paid workers, promised a £7 minimum wage by the Chancellor and given just 19p an hour. Under this government, it's an economy of the privileged, by the privileged, for the privileged. And Mr Deputy Speaker, instead of today admitting the truth about what is happening in most people's lives, they want to tell them the opposite. They tell people their wages are rising when they're falling, just like they tell people their energy bills are falling when they're rising. And they tell people they're better off, but everyone knows the truth. Mr Deputy Speaker, you can change the shape of the pound, but it doesn't matter if the pound is square, round or oval. If you're £1,600 a year worse off, you're still £1,600 a year worse off. You're worse off under the Tories. And the reason they can't deliver, is because of what they believe. His global race is a race to the bottom. People forced to do two or even three jobs to make ends meet, not knowing how many hours they're going to get from one week to the next, and no idea what the future holds for their kids. Low wages, low skills, insecure work. That is how they think Britain succeeds. That, Mr Deputy Speaker, is why they're not the solution to the cost of living crisis. They are the problem. And we needed a budget today that would have made the long-term changes our economy needs in housing, banking and energy. But they can't do it. They won't stand up to the vested interests. They won't tackle developers sitting on land, even though they can't solve the housing crisis without it. They won't force the banks to improve competition, even though small businesses say they need it. They won't stand up to the energy companies and freeze energy bills, even though the public support it. Same old Tories. And Mr Deputy Speaker, we know what their long-term plan is. More tax cuts for the richest, while everyone else gets squeezed.
Well, I hadn't heard that before, actually. I was speaking at a demonstration in just outside Downing Street, probably when that was being done. But, I mean, it's very good what he says. But there's a problem with it, isn't there? The fact of the matter, he does, I think, very well articulate how bad the Tories are and the fact that they don't care about ordinary people. But the problem that Ed Miliband has is, and maybe why his Chancellor was sitting in the background, or his shadow Chancellor, is that they are committed to sticking to the Tories' spending plans. And what that means for working people is a continuation of austerity. That's where the problem lies. You see, going back to the point you made earlier about the media, I think it's important we make this point. Yes, the establishment will always try to get its point of view across, but the reason they can pack a Question Time audiences and not Question Time audiences, Question Time panels with people who are given one message that there's no alternative to austerity is because there's a political consensus amongst all the major parties in the UK. There's no alternative to the market, but it's worse than that. There's no alternative to the market in its most extreme form, that is neoliberalism. So I'm glad to hear what Ed Miliband said. For what it's worth, I think sticking with the Question 11 standards could possibly win them the election, but you don't want to look too closely at what they've got to say, because in reality, it's the same as the Tories. It's austerity light as opposed to the hard line austerity that Osborne wants to is actually imposing.
So what have you got to say to that, Martin? Austerity light, what you're getting is actually just a slightly diluted version of the Conservatives' plans if you're going to listen to Ed Miliband and vote Labour.
That's unfortunately the case. I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, Rachel Reeves the other day was coming out, and we'll have to consider, a new Labour government will have to consider removing all benefits for the under 25s. Now, I thought there was an absolutely nutty idea, which had been dreamed up somewhere at Bilderberg, and then the Tories were coming out with it, floating the idea, let's get rid of all benefits for under 25s. And you feel like saying, this is the military age males you're talking about here. And then Rachel Reeves comes out with exactly the same statement. Perhaps we'll have to consider getting rid of all benefits for under 25s. And this is what they call triangulation. So they know there's anger out there in the streets. They know that there's a Tory government there. So they want to channel that anger, but they want to channel it in such a way that, in other words, when they come to power, they will be basically doing deals with the vested interest that he's attacking there. Now, at the same time, I still say to people, vote Labour. The leaders of the Labour Party have always been of this ilk. It's the nature of the beast, but that doesn't mean
certainly
that we can afford to keep this government in power.
I would say
we
certainly can't. Since the Callaghan era. Martin, is there any reason to believe that the Labour Party would change its tune after the election, or do you think that they really are so wedded to what they see as a sort of city consensus, a national consensus formed in London, that they are going to go through and carry on with these austerity, like you were talking about there with Rachel Reeves and saying, under 25 shouldn't be receiving benefit?
Well, let's just make this point. I'm in the Labour Party to frustrate people like Rachel Reeves, and I'm not leaving. What will happen actually is there's going to be a crash caused by a war in Ukraine or in Syria or by Greece defaulting or by Thailand defaulting or Ukraine defaulting, and at that point all bets will be off, and all of this stuff we've got to work within the city consensus and all the rest of it, when the banks go down like nine pins and we really get a capitalist crisis, because we're going to get one, there's absolutely no way out of this. And in the Labour Party in the past, they used to have people around who understood economics and realised that there was going to be a crash, but of course nobody can talk about there's going to be a crash because we've all got to pretend that the market is working,
now,
which it isn't.
You showed me this quite fascinating report, French report translated into English, called Leap 2020, this week. It says, build a trap to divert Europe away from its own destiny. It's quite a complex document, but ultimately they seem to be suggesting that because the Chinese and the Russians hold so much of the West's debt generally, they've actually in a way got them over a barrel, that there's no way. I mean, what ultimately would it mean that at some point the West might just stick two fingers up to the Chinese, stick two fingers up to the Russians and say, well, actually, we're not going to repay any of that?
Well, they could.
That could be disastrous, couldn't it?
They could do that. What's likely to happen? I mean, this is Leap 2020, by the way. It's a French-based think tank. They're usually pretty accurate. They've been predicting everything pretty accurately all the way through the crisis. They call it global systemic crisis. And I'll just read briefly the last paragraph here. The Ukrainian crisis was probably triggered for no other reason than ultimately to force us, Europe, to buy US shale gas, to sign this new trade agreement with the Americans, without which the former gas can't be sold, and to justify a renewed increase of American NATO military budgets. So, in other words, this crisis is designed to undermine the European Union as an independent actor in world affairs. So they're now locked into confrontation. I mean, the logical thing for the European Union to do is be friendly with Russia and friendly with the US, but we're not going to be allowed to do that.
But you're talking about something called the TTIP. They are talking, and you're talking about something called the TTIP, which I'd not heard of before. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. They're trying to get people to sign this. Why?
Well, it makes a free market between the European Union and the North American Free Trade Zone, which in other words means that all of the intervention, which, you know, Europe is more interventionist historically than the US, that things like demanding that bankers' bonuses might be taxed and so on are on the agenda in Europe, they're not on the agenda in the US. And that once we've signed this trade deal, George Monbiot's been pretty good on this in The Guardian, then the European Union and individual countries within the European Union, like Britain, will lose control of their economic policy completely to Washington. And that's, and of course, we're so frightened of the Russians that we better sign up for that, otherwise the Russians are going to invade us.
Oh, interesting idea. Anyway, so folks, it's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, if you want to go and have a look at that, the TTIP. Now, to move on to a sports story, I'm joined by Paul Davis, who's BCFM sports editor. Now, Bristol Rovers, Paul, are celebrating this week, aren't they, after the judicial review into whether they can sell off to Sainsbury's was dismissed.
Yes, indeed, Tony. The football club finally allowed to sell the Memorial Stadium to a supermarket chain, opening the way for a £40 million facility. Last week, a High Court judge heard evidence in a legal challenge brought by campaign group Trash Horfield. It argued planning permission for a Sainsbury's store at the ground failed to consider the impact on local shops. Bristol Rovers chairman Nick Higgs was present for 6 hours of legal argument at the Bristol Civil Justice Centre and said the High Court judge had taken on board the urgency of sorting the matter out. Justice Higginbotham dismissed the complaint from the traders group, paving the way for a supermarket. During the hearing, Trash Horfield claimed that when Bristol City Councillors made the decision to approve the Sainsbury's store, they were not fully aware of a study predicting a £7 million impact on traders on the Gloucester Road by 2017. But Bristol City Council said the proper planning processes were followed and properly and clearly drawn to the reader's attention. Handing down the judgment, Mr. Justice Higginbotham said Trash Horfield had 7 days to appeal. We shall see. A statement from the Bristol Green Party acknowledges that the judge hadn't supported the challenge to Bristol City Council made by the JR. It reads, the Trash Horfield campaign has raised large sums of money from the public, which shows that many local traders and residents felt the planning process had unlawfully overridden their objections. The very fact that this case got to court demonstrates there was a case to be answered by Bristol City Council. We regret that the judge did not think these arguments to be sufficiently strong, but accept the decision nonetheless. So Bristol Rovers, or the Pirates as they are affectionately known, sail into another port after time spent at Eastville, Twerton Park, the Memorial Stadium, and after the Eastville fire, even Ashton Gate, believe it or not. A new stadium at French A in tandem with the University of the West of England will not only create new jobs, but there will be a conference facility, corporate hospitality, a gym, some retail shops, 1,000 car park spaces, and most of all, a lot more hope for professional football in the city. They may be leaving the Memorial Stadium, intrinsically a rugby ground, but reminders of its past will still be there next to Sainsbury's supermarket. The old memorial to the professional rugby players who gave their lives in the Great War will remain in a specially landscaped garden. Quite apt, really, as this year we remember the 100th anniversary of the war to end all wars. What is it they say about sport? It's just war without the fighting? After decades without a home to truly call their own, the Huey Stadium, or perhaps even the Jeff Bradford Stadium, is close to reality. Rovers fans are used to putting up with substandard stadiums. I, for one, as a supporter, watched the gas in various new stadia around the country, enviously for 36 years and counting. It's time to say goodnight, Irene, now, to past disappointments and bring on the future.
But am I right that Bristol Rovers moved, actually, within recent memory from the Eastville Park Junction on the M32? They had a stadium there, didn't they?
At Eastville Stadium, yes. They came to the league in 1920 and were there until 1985. And then the rent was increased on the ground, which was owned by a Bristol Greyhound company who ran the Speedway and the Greyhound racing there. And, of course, they were basically pushed out of the stadium and had to go to share with non-league Bath City for 10 years. Very successful years in the club's history. They won promotion to what is now the Championship, the second tier of English football, and they had a final at Wembley, a lower division cup final to attend as well, which they unfortunately lost. But yeah, they had a good 10 years there. But it's been, coming back to Bristol hasn't been the best thing on the field, but certainly off the field the facilities have to be improved. Bristol City have an all-seater stadium. Bristol Rovers must have the same, and unlike a lot of grounds, for example Brighton's Amex Stadium is a fairly new facility, you know, the stadium has to be improved. Of course, the Taylor Report has to come into that as well if Bristol Rovers were ever to rise from the bottom of the tier of English football.
A lot of people are also pointing at this and saying, well, actually, this is just a bit of a planning scam, that one of the things that you can do is buy cheap land over near the University of the West of England. If you get your planning permission on that to turn it into a stadium, suddenly it's worth millions. And this is a way of financially propping up a club, which is actually, that is the main problem with Bristol Rovers. Not that they're having problems on the field, it's that they're having problems with with their balance sheet.
Yeah, true, Tony. I mean, clubs in the lower two divisions, they must be losing money hand over fist every season. They can't be making profits, that's for sure. Bristol City are millions and millions in debt, as well as Bristol Rovers. So both clubs have troubled finances. But I think all the supporters care about is an actual experience, I mean, of going to see a football match in some sort of comfort and not, you know, with basically having rain and snow all, you know, on top of them and not really having much shelter and things like that, and a decent food facilities, decent bar facilities, things like that. I mean, take away the financial aspect. I mean, you know, we can talk about the economy as you've been talking about. You know, in the first hour of the show, you've been, you know, saying that the economy is basically being held to ransom by the Americans. Well, we can all go and commit suicide, I guess, to that thought. You know, I mean, where do we go from there? I mean, you could say, but it's a small microcosm of our culture in this country, and it needs to be attended to. And football stadiums are important for the community. They do a lot of good work, Bristol Rovers, in the community. And I've spoken to Nick Higgs at length on this matter. I didn't get a response from the Bristol Green Party and Danielle Everdici in particular. They emailed me and said they couldn't speak at all.
That's probably because they're holding their cards a bit close to their chest.
Possibly.
This could carry on.
Yeah, will they appeal? We'll see. They've got 7 days to appeal. It's very unlikely, but we shall see. It's disappointing, really, in terms of finances. But a community club that serves a community very well, Bristol Rovers have done that, and Bristol City have done that very, very well. So I think it's I'm a football fan, so I'm going to vote for it.
Okay, Paul Davis, BCFM sports editor, thanks very much for joining us. Now, our next story, employees at Scotland Yard. Last week it was the Bank of England employees, but this week the employees at Scotland Yard were ordered to carry out mass shredding of the Stephen Lawrence evidence, claims a damning review of the Met. This is Tom Harper, their investigative reporter in the Independent on Tuesday. Two employees of Scotland Yard were ordered to shred a lorry load of police corruption intelligence, according to evidence submitted to a damning review of the Metropolitan Police. Top secret material gathered during a 4-year investigation codenamed Operation Othona was inexplicably destroyed in 2003, according to a report into the murder of Stephen Lawrence commissioned by Home Secretary Theresa May. Now, Martin, I know this is something you've been following. Now, this does sound very suspicious. I mean, surely destroying all this evidence, that looks to me a prima facie case there of interfering with or perverting the course of justice.
Well, it is, and whoever gave the order to have these documents shredded should be prosecuted if there has been a perversion of the course of justice. That's the only way to stop this kind of thing.
Well, I mean, we've had the same last week with the Bank of England shredding loads and loads of possibly incriminating material. The police doing the same. This is just not good enough, is it? Surely these people are entrusted with keeping these records, and so that there can be possible court cases to come in the future. I suppose you might say, though, well, can you blame them for getting rid of the evidence that might incriminate them?
Well, indeed, but of course it's all illegal, as we're constantly told. And if we're going to send young lads to prison for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water in a riot, what are we going to do when senior police officers trash a vanload of evidence? It can't be just 2 years in prison, can it?
John, I wonder if you've got a view on this and maybe the implications of the wider Lawrence case, because we heard, didn't we, that the family was actually, immediately after the murder, was actually infiltrated by the Metropolitan Police as well.
Yeah, well, Doreen Lawrence is actually spoken at our conference on two occasions. Our union has been absolutely committed to supporting the Lawrence case, absolutely opposed to racism and absolutely opposed to the abuse of power, because I guess really what we're talking about here is institutions or people at the head of institutions, certainly, who think they're above the law. We're looking at the News of the World trial at the present time with that, what's her name, Brooks, Andy Coulson. They actually believed they could get away with anything. And as far as the police are concerned, you know, this surveillance did take place in terms of the Lawrence family itself. It was also surveillance on activists. There was infiltration of various organisations, you know, peaceful organisations like Greenpeace and environmental organisations. It's absolutely unacceptable from the viewpoint of anybody who believes in any kind of democratic society. But It's also unsustainable because there's more and more coming to light, and the feeling I've got is now that the you know, they've opened Pandora's box now, and I'm not quite sure exactly what they're going to find, but I think there's a growing mood in society for accountability of our institutions, whether it be banks, whether it be the police. I don't think anybody can justify what they've done at Hillsborough. I remember that very, very clearly, and I think there's a growing mood in society that these people have got to behave with decency, they've got to behave actually in a professional manner, and they've got to behave within the bounds of the law. But I think the days of taking us for granted are, you know, are certainly being challenged, if not disappearing.
Okay, on to another subject, and Mark Leftley is reporting in The Independent, again another one from The Independent. The track isn't built yet, but the gravy train is running. There's an announcement this week about a fast-tracked, if you can call it that, HS2. High-speed rail link. Westminster Sir David Higgins publishes his much-anticipated report this week into the revamping of High Speed 2 on Monday. The Aussie saviour of London 2012 will try the same trick by cutting £1.5 billion off of costs from the £50 billion railway. Braying MPs up and down the proposed London to Birmingham route are ready to point out that a 3% saving is next to pointless, but a parliamentary answer this week showed that the consultancy Atkins is working on more than £40 million worth of contracts, while CH2M Hill has already received £35 million. A small part of HS2's budget, yes, but still an awful lot of money. Is HS2 too big to fail? This is another question here. A lot of money. I mean, a bit like these IT systems you were talking about earlier. Massive amounts of money has already been pumped into this HS2, and a decision still hasn't actually been made as to whether it's really going to go ahead or not.
Well, we come back again to the question of accountability, and right at the centre of this, and this applies to all the utilities, the gas, electricity. Incidentally, I think it applies to the banks as well. You can control what you don't own. And what we need to see, I mean, as far as HS2 is concerned, I'm not going to pretend I know all the arguments around it. What I do know is that we need the railway system brought back into public ownership. I think that's absolutely vital. And we have to stop the you know, the drive towards privatisation and society as a well. But as far as HS2 is concerned, what we need is a proper integrated transport system. If there's new technology, if there's better trains, that's good. But you know what we see in terms of I mean, I spend a lot of time in the London. As you know, the RMT union was in strike just a while back in terms of the London underground, where people like Johnson, Boris Johnson, push this theory that everything can be resolved by technology, whether it be driverless trains or faster trains. But the fact of the matter is, we need a transport system that needs people's needs, that works for us, and a transport a system that's accessible to the broad mass of the population, because in actual fact it's getting more and more expensive to travel. I don't know how some people can actually
it's a bit like the Bristol Arena that they've been talking about. I wonder how many of the poorer people in Bristol are going to be able to use HS2 or the arena. A lot of these projects, I've heard them described as vanity projects. Martin, what about this though? Because surely HS2 is exactly the sort of thing we need, an infrastructure project which is going to create jobs.
Well, I'm in favour of infrastructure projects, but what we learned from past history is that infrastructure projects, I don't know, just as an example, the Aswan Dam in Egypt, can be completely misguided. And the way you protect yourself from doing completely misguided things is to do small things, do lots of small things instead of one big thing. This is a headline-seeking thing. If you wanted to stimulate the economy, you could take the same amount of money, which is going to be spent on this, and spend it on something else and get more bang for your buck in terms of job creation. This is actually about making London more accessible from the provinces. It's not actually about improving the provinces' chances of competing with London. And I think Ed Balls is actually, unlike Ed Miliband, is saying that he may well cancel this project. I think I'd need to see a lot more figures that convince me that this money was going to be well spent in this particular format.
Okay. On a very related subject, an article this week in Business Insider, Bill Gates is saying people don't realise how many many jobs will soon be replaced by software bots. Bill Gates is $9 billion richer than he was a year ago, but most of his wealth is not in Microsoft. Big changes are coming to the labour market that people in governments aren't prepared for, Bill Gates believes. Speaking in Washington, D.C., economic think tank the American Enterprise Institute on Thursday, Gates said that within 20 years, a lot of jobs will just go away, replaced by software automation. Bots, in technical slang, although Gates used the term software substitution. This is what he said. Software substitution, whether it's for drivers or waiters or nurses, it's progressing. Technology over time will reduce demand for jobs, particularly at the lower end of the skill set. 20 years from now, labour demand for lots of skill sets will be substantially lower. I don't think people have that in their mental model. John, what he's saying there is not more jobs, but less jobs. Now, the opportunity with this technology is that maybe people could be freed up to have a lot more leisure time, but it doesn't seem as if they're going to be given that. It seems as if they're simply going to be told, well, you haven't got a job, you haven't got an income, and you're going to have to try and work for next to nothing.
I'm old enough to remember when I was younger watching a programme called Tomorrow's World, that they told us that by the time we reached, well, now, really, the 21st century, that we would all be working 15 hours a week or 20 hours a week, and everything else would be getting done by robots. It was going to be a brave new world. Now, Martin, of course, is the economist, and I'm sure he'll tell you, you don't make profit out of machines, you make profit out of human beings. And that is a big flaw in the plan, as far as the system is concerned. What you cannot do is produce a system, under capitalism, you can't produce a situation where people get the leisure they deserve, where they enjoy life, where they've got an artistic and a cultural life to live, and spend only 15 hours a week at work, because the system isn't organised that way. It's based on profit.
Martin, is there any way that instead of having a handful of people owning everything and everybody else clamouring for just a few crumbs, that we could share things out more and actually have people, most people, only having to work maybe 1 or 2 days a week with all this technology around?
Well, in the 1970s, that's exactly the sort of thought that was put forward.
But can we actually do that? I mean, yes. Why is it?
No, well, you can't do it under the existing setup, because the existing setup is driven by private profit. Now, I keep repeating this, but it's worth repeating. The private market, financial market, was bailed out by the state in 2008. Now, if you were going to follow a free market policy, those banks shouldn't have been bailed out, and there should have been.
Yeah, but they were. Come on, we have to live in the real world.
Oh, yes, okay. So at that point, we have no longer got a free market policy. What we've got is a feudalistic policy of subsidy for the wealthy and austerity and worse for the poor and the disadvantaged. Now, the problem with all of this at the end of the day is that everybody cuts everybody else's wages and you throw people out of work and you won't pay them any benefits. Who is going to buy all the stuff that these robots have produced? And then of course, you solve that problem by saying, well, we're only going to be producing missiles because all we're producing here is war. And that's ultimately where capitalism is going to take us unless we stop it. We've actually reached the point, this is the 21st century, 2014, we kill capitalism or capitalism kills us. It's as simple as that. But, of course, you can't expect to hear that from the Labour front bench. They're playing a different game.
And we didn't hear it from Kerry McCarthy, so let's go to hear her at Westminster at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where she's talking about both Tony Benn and the cost of living crisis. She's our local MP, Labour MP for Bristol East.
Kerry McCarthy!
Mr Speaker, can I first, speaking for myself, Madam Deputy Speaker, and the people of Bristol, who he served so well for 30 years, join with the tributes to Tony Benn and the condolences to his family. Mr Speaker, Tony Benn was from a very privileged background, yet he spent his political life fighting for the working people. With the cost of living crisis, wages falling by £1,600 a year, people queuing at food banks, so much that requires the Prime Minister's attention, just why is it that he seems so obsessed with plans to bring back fox hunting by the back door for the benefit of a privileged few?
First of all, can I, can
I join the Honourable Lady in paying tribute to Tony Benn as a constituency MP? He was always an incredibly busy backbencher and minister, but he never forgot about his constituents. And also, he was also very good with a friendly, helpful word for new backbenchers, whatever side of the House you happen to be on. And I'm sure many members like me experienced that from him. In terms of what we're doing to help the poorest in our country, the most important thing is getting people back to work. And the fact that we've now seen 1.7 million new private sector jobs under this government is the best way of helping people sustainably out of poverty. And as they come out of poverty, they're going to see a higher minimum wage and also the ability to earn more money before they pay any taxes at all. Those are the government's priorities. That's our long-term plan, and that's what you're going to hear about.
John McAnally, National Vice President of PCS Union, Public and Commercial Services Union. 1.7 million new private sector jobs. Isn't the problem that you would prefer them to be public sector jobs? But David Cameron is in the driving seat.
Absolutely not. I mean, there's nothing wrong with creating jobs in the private sector, but I think you'll find that, and it's reflected in this great contract that's going on at the present time when they talk about falling unemployment. In actual fact, what you have is massive underemployment in this country with people on zero or contracts and part-time work and so on. Yes, we want more public sector jobs, but we also want private sector jobs as well. But let me tell you the two reasons why we need public sector jobs. We in the southwest of England, mainly, but in other parts of the country, we've just had the floods. And it is a fact that the cuts to government departments, the cuts to local authorities, etc., was a contributing factor to the severity of the impact, as far as that's concerned. And we don't see much of that in the press, because the fact of the matter is, in most government departments now, the services, the valuable services that our members work hard to put into the communities are actually being cut, and that means that people don't have what they need to maintain a decent lifestyle. In some terms, and sometimes they don't have the support they need to stay safe, actually.
Now, before we come to the Murdoch News at 6, I want to cover this last story, because it really stood out to me in The Guardian. The truth is out. Money is just an IOU, and the banks are rolling in it. The Bank of England's dose of honesty throws the theoretical basis for austerity out of the window. This is David Grabner in The Guardian on Tuesday. Back in the 1930s, Henry Ford is supposed to have remarked that it was a good thing that most Americans didn't know how banking really works, because if they did, there'd be a revolution before tomorrow morning. Last week, something remarkable happened. The Bank of England let the cat out of the bag in a paper called Money Creation in the Modern Economy, co-authored by three economists from the Bank's Monetary Analysis Directorate. They stated outright that the most common assumption of how banking works are simply wrong, and the kind of populist heterodox positions that are ordinarily associated with groups such as Occupy Wall Street are correct.
Well, that's right. I mean, Graeber is actually a historian. I've read his book about the history of debt. The truth will out. In actual fact, the money supply, as I said earlier, is being created by the private sector with no control whatsoever. And there is, you know, the idea that people give money to banks and then they lend that money on is fantastical. And John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, years ago said that the creation of money is so simple that the mind is repelled. But of course, underlying the whole system is a whole contract.
And it seems to me as if a kind of monopolistic capturing of the supply of money has been going on. Also, ought to say something about our sister station, Ujima, which has been off the air for quite a while without any kind of real announcement on the radio on Ujima 98, exactly what's been going on there. But it's become quite clear now, I think, because Ujima presenters and producers and managers couldn't actually get in to the building. Bristol City Council are reviewing the unsatisfactory leasehold of the company involved in a row which led to the silencing of community radio station Ujima. That's in the Bristol Post today. Seed are the leaseholders of Wilder House in St Paul's, where Ujima Radio broadcasts live. But last week, broadcasters were shut out of their studios in a dispute over electricity bills. Bristol Mayor George Ferguson has stepped in to resolve the 10-day standoff. I don't know if he's dug into his pocket and paid those bills, so who knows. And the radio station is set to go live again this Monday. The Mayor also announced the Council's agreement with Seed is to be reviewed. Ujima Radio said they were shut out of their offices on the 10th of March, after power was disconnected by the utilities warehouse following unpaid bills. Seed claimed during the dispute that Ujima had not been paying its fair share for the building, which is also rented out to other businesses. So some good news there, at least, that we should be seeing Ujima hopefully back on the radio, our sister station, sister community radio station, as of Monday. Now, it's pretty much time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock, and you've been listening to Reviewing the News, John McInerney, who's PCS Union's National Vice Chair. After the Murdoch News, Ukraine.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a woman who had acid thrown in her face by a friend has told a court she considered killing herself after suffering life-changing scars. A 22-year-old attacker disguised herself in a Muslim veil before doing it in London in 2012. She's been jailed for 12 years. Detective Chief Inspector David Wellham says the attack was horrific.
Anyone that can harbour a grudge for the best part of 2 years over something so inconsequential as an argument over looks or just silly little things that happen, and then can go into the degree of planning that she has, is a very dangerous individual.
A potentially life-saving vaccine against meningitis B is to be made available for babies on the NHS. Ministers now need to agree costs with the manufacturer. A woman and her husband have admitted burying her parents in the back garden of their home nearly...